Welcome to Lives in Leadership. This podcast is dedicated to promoting thoughtful and strategic conversations about military leadership, ethics, culture, and service in the profession of arms within the Australian Defence Force. My name is Dr. Lucas Murray, and in today's episode, I'm joined by Rear Admiral Lee Goddard, whose 34-year career in the Royal Australian Navy has been characterised by leadership at sea and in strategic national security roles. Lee has made significant contributions across operational, policy, and strategic domains. His leadership experience includes commanding warships, managing maritime operations, and helping to shape defence policy. Beyond his military service, Rear Admiral Goddard has brought his expertise to the private sector, serving as CEO of the Australian Missile Corporation and working on innovative projects in sovereign defence capabilities. Lee, welcome to the Lives in Leadership podcast. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Lucas, and I really appreciate that introduction. So probably more than I deserve, but I'll take it. So cheers.
Lee, having commanded ships, led crisis responses, and now reviewed leadership across the ADF, I really want to ask, what does leadership mean to you?
As I reflect on my leadership journey, and it's been far from perfect, I look forward to sharing some of my stories of when things went well and perhaps when they didn't go so well. I think there's probably five things. One is leadership's about always turning up, setting the example, setting the tone. Secondly, it's just simply leading, making sure that you every day realise that you have an accountability and responsibility as a leader to simply lead. Leadership's also about giving those who work and I guess that you do actually lead, giving them what they need every day, not necessarily what they want. Sometimes they're the same, but they're quite a different. Leadership's about knowing your people. And in fact, I think that's been a strength of mine. And sometimes it's been a shortcoming. And then finally, I think as a leader at my stage in the career is actually every day reflecting and looking down saying, how can I unblock so that the people I'm leading can get on and do the jobs that they need? Especially when you're working in the government or the Canberra environment, how can you unblock? And as a leader, you have an accountability and responsibility to do that every single day.
Can I ask what you mean by unblock?
Well, you often find that your team want to do things and they want to do it really well, but there's always a barrier that maybe perhaps is either artificial or it's real, or maybe you're even contributing to as a leader. So you look down and think, if you want to move more effectively, faster, more efficiently, how can you unblock as a leader on behalf of your team? So looking down, and of course, you know, managing up, managing sideways, managing down, of course, is all part of leadership. But in particular, unblocking down is a really critical part of leadership in the, I guess, the Canberra whole of government and in the environment that we find ourselves, when, especially in the national security environment.
And I really like the point you said about knowing your people. I feel like in terms of, you know, having oversight on some of the units and some of the, I guess, organisations that you've had to lead, knowing your people can be, it's an easy thing to say, but what does it actually look like in practice? Are there any examples you have of knowing or not knowing your people and how that's kind of led to success or failure in some kind of particular way?
Yes, Lucas. Look, I think when I've been best as a leader, it's because I've really known my people. And perhaps from time to time, when I failed as a leader, because I didn't know something about somebody in my team. And for an example is that somebody might turn up at work and they do something which is, it could be insubordinate, it could be, they could be late. And often your inkling is to perhaps throw them under the bus and deal with the bad behaviour. Sure, sometimes you have to address it, but often you have to reflect, why is that person behaving or different today? What didn't I pick up? Take a moment to, once you've dealt, to go back and find out. And you often find that people, if they're behaving differently, it's because there's an issue in their life or there's some kind of maybe external or internal factor that perhaps you should have picked on. And good leaders, they're not perfect, but if they know their people, they will pick up on those factors.
Yeah, that's a good point. You also talked about the differences of leadership in different sorts of, whether it's defence or government or industry. What have you come to understand about leadership, perhaps, that you didn't appreciate fully earlier in your career? You know, maybe joining the Defence Force as a vision of leadership, a version of leadership, perhaps, that works well in that context. And has that changed over time? Or what have you learned about the journey that you've been on?
Well, I think early in your career, your leadership journey is very, very personal about you as a leader and maybe perhaps how you're directing a team and driving things into black and white versus ambiguity. In fact, as a leader, you should be very good at working in ambiguity, but trying to provide as much black and white direction and environment to the team that you're actually leading. But of course, as you get more senior or more experienced, you then focus on the organisation, you know, creating systems, processes, cultures to allow others to lead. And that's the critical thing as you move through your career. Rather, sure, it's still a personal journey. You've still got to focus on yourself and from time to time look in the mirror and still turn up and do all those traits that I spoke about, you know, as a leader. But yeah, that's where the change is, how you are setting the tone for the organisation. High-performing teams have five attributes. And I'm involved, of course, in offshore sailing, and I chair the Sydney Hobart Yacht Race. And I often get asked a question, how can you get a team together, say, in early December, and 2 or 3 weeks later, they're taking on one of the most physically and challenging sporting events in the world as a high-performing team? And there's five traits that I focus on. One is to make sure that team has a common purpose, a common vision, and that you as a leader are articulating it well and everyone owns it. The second is that you have good processes in place, which then turn into good principles and then turn into good behaviours. Everyone goes straight to behaviours and principles, but you still need to have good processes. Everyone knows their job and does it well. You've got to have good communications. You've got to be talking to each other. And in any organisation, externally, internally, good communications. Fourth, you've got to have a high level of trust. And that's hard earned sometimes. And the fifth one, which I find is often the shortcoming in high-performing teams, is role clarity. Mm-hmm. If you get role clarity right, and that's why in even those tougher situations in the Sydney to Hobart Yacht Race, and even I've seen it at sea and when I've been on a bridge, when it gets really tough, if you have those five traits of the high-performing team, things just happen. And they happen really well, especially with role clarity, trust, good communication, good processes, and common vision. You know when it's not going well, because those who normally talk a lot shut up, and those who normally don't say much start talking. You think, well, this isn't going so well. So how's your leader? How are you going to bring it back to that high-performing team and getting those five traits back into place again?
That's wonderful. I really like those five traits. Is there like a particular example that, particularly in the ADF, that might be useful to think about those traits in practice?
Well, I think, again, as a leader, when things aren't going well, there's a lot of ambiguity. And you're trying to drive the situation into a black and white environment for those who you are leading. Right. So they can then get on and do the things. They then revert to good processes. They revert to good communication. They trust each other. And they revert to, you know, role clarity. People know what to do when they... So I think that's really you're setting the tone. Remember, as a leader, though, you're comfortable working that ambiguity. That's fine. But sometimes it's an advantage. But often in those kind of crisis situations, it's driving back to those traits of a high-performing team. I can give plenty of examples where I have had to act very calm in a situation. When you're actually as a leader, you're anything but calm. But, of course, you've got to turn up and you've got to make sure your team sees you as a leader and starts to drive these outcomes. I've told the story before. One of my first memories of being on a warship was in the Malacca Strait. It was on HMAS Perth in 1990. And then the then captain, he wouldn't mind me saying his name because I've just been working with him, was Captain Chris Oxenbold. And I remember it was all going bad at 3 o'clock in the morning in the middle of the Malacca Strait, the busiest sea lane then in the world, literally a Singapore Strait. And I remember the officer of the watch, and I was the junior officer, called the captain to the bridge. And Captain Oxenbold came to the bridge at 3 o'clock in the morning. Everyone said, that's my captain. The bridge parted. He put on his binoculars, went to the bridge window, said a few things, sat down, and the tone was set. And it was just calm again. And everyone reverted to the high-performing traits.
Right.
Fast forward about 20 years later, I was commanding HMAS Perth. In fact, it was actually HMAS Parramatta. I did command an HMAS, and it was one of the first times I'd gone to sea. It was about 3 o'clock in the morning, not far actually from where I'd had that incident, in 1990. I think it was in 2007. Again, I was called to the bridge. The junior officer of the watch was doing the right thing. Captain, I need your support. This isn't going well. There's ships everywhere. Bridge parted. I calmly grabbed the binoculars, went to the bridge window. Everyone looked at the back of my head, and all of a sudden the tone was calm. I'm looking through the binoculars going, what the hell am I going to do now? So there's actually a bit of an act of command, yeah. But the fact that I was actually able to lower the tone. I actually spoke to Admiral Chris Oxenbould about it years later and asked about him. And he said, I did exactly the same thing. Lowered the tone, but same thing. I looked through the binoculars and thought, my goodness, this is a tough situation. But just portrayed that act of calm to make sure that, as a leader, because everyone's watching you. It's interesting on a warship. I often get asked about when you've succeeded as a captain by commanding officers. And I always say there's an example that I had early in my command on HMAS Parramatta was when you first come on board, people refer to you as the captain.
Right.
Because you're the captain, you're a person of authority, and you go down the main passageway and you may find a sailor, and it may be with his parents or his girlfriend or boyfriend. And as you walk past, they say, that's the captain. You know you're successful because 3 months later, they've observed you. They've observed you in those tough situations. You've set the tone. You've provided the framework for those traits of a high-performing team. And 3 months later, you go past that same junior sailor with his mum or dad or boyfriend or girlfriend. And they don't say that's the captain. They say that's my captain.
Right.
It changes the whole dynamic because now you're very important to them as their leader. It's my captain, not the captain. And I reckon that's when you know you're being successful as a leader on board a warship.
Yeah, that connection to the team.
That's correct.
Really interesting. That's a great story as well to think about the practical nature of holding that sort of command role, right? That you're dealing with an uncertain, ambiguous, maybe high-pressure environment. But what practices or what things that do you need to do to kind of perform a sense of, I guess, what word you'd call it, leadership, a command, a sense of stability for the team so that they know that they can trust you and that it's, to do their job well. They can't be dealing with that uncertain, ambiguous environment. That's sort of maybe something you need to take on. I think that's really fascinating.
And that's command presence. And, of course, that's very different from maybe a leadership demeanour here in Canberra or in the whole of government space. It works very effectively at sea, very effectively maybe in that military environment. But then you need to adapt to a different environment when you're here in Canberra. So that, I guess, that directive style or command presence versus the collaborative influencing style that you then need to shift to is very important that you don't conflate the two. I was very privileged to, command the surface force or surface fleet in Sydney. And it was, it was 18 warships, lots of sailors, soldiers, public servants in Sydney, very operational and a fantastic role. My next position was actually to arrive in the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet. And they often say that the most sulkiest people in Canberra are ex-commanding officers and ex-ambassadors because you go from this very privileged position as a commander to really to working maybe in an office environment in Canberra. And unlike when you're commander of a service force, everyone wears uniforms, everyone wears name tags. You actually can tell everyone has medals. You can tell a lot about a person before they've even spoken to you. You go to somewhere like Prime Minister and Cabinet for the first time. Everyone's in a suit, no one wears name tags, no one wears uniforms. You cannot assume anything. You actually have to get to know people. And that's when I made some mistakes. I actually misjudged a couple of people from the first or second day I met them because of the way I engaged them. An example would be I met a young professional public servant who'd been in PMC, Prime Minister and Cabinet, for about 12 months.
Yep.
When I first met him, I thought I was meeting Smithers to Montgomery Burns out of The Simpsons. Just the way he dressed and conducted himself. And Australian Defence Force people can be very judgmental. You're not like us. But within a week, I got to know this person. He turned out to be one of the hardest working people. He'd come up from a single parent family. He'd worked hard. His mother had worked hard. And boy, oh boy, could he write. And he turned out to be a very close professional colleague, but also a close friend, and he made me look good. I mean, I thought I could write. I did the ONA, or then ONA, now ONI writing course, and got taken apart, like most military officers, versus me completely relying on this individual. And the more I got to know him, as I said, the more I liked him as a human, as a person. And it was, even though he was working for me, our relationship was very different from, say, my relationship with that sailor who was with his parents saying, that's my captain. And I really enjoyed that period of adaption.
Definitely. It's interesting because I do think, I mean, I've only been working for the Department of Defence for 2 years, but I understand that honours and awards are a useful way not just to know, you know, who I'm speaking to, but to understand the experience of how long they've perhaps been in a certain unit, what they've done, where. And I think it's a useful way to kind of start to build a sort of connection with that person, a kind of understanding them. Whereas, yes, of course, and I'm sure in PM&C, that's, it's really hard. You've got to, you don't really know where they've come from, what they've done, what their skills and strengths are. And you have to kind of, I don't know, what would you say are sort of the qualities of leadership that you need to
navigate
your
people,
that space?
Just get to know your people. Yep. I think. And first of all, just what you said, Lucas, is incredibly respectful for you to talk about the Australian Defence Force and realise that medals and uniform is important to them, and it's a story. That's high EQ. But I tell ADF people, they've got to do the same. They've got to actually appreciate they're now in maybe a different environment. And find out the stories of, you know, and you'll be surprised about why people join the Department of Defence as a public servant. And you'll find that there's a lot of great Australians who care about their country, worked hard. They may have had a reason they couldn't join the military. Mm. You know, there might have been a physical reason or some other reason, et cetera, as well, but they're still there in focus. And that kind of mutual respect is really important. I had the privilege again of commanding Maritime Border Command and Operation Sovereign Borders, and that covers about 14 or 15 government agencies in terms of intelligence agencies and other supporting groups. But primarily it's the Australian Border Force, the Australian Defence Force. And when I arrived, there was always a natural tension between the Defence Force and the Border Force because they're different and different focuses. But I realised with the Border Force, all they wanted was respect who they are, where they joined, where they came from. That disproportionate respect versus a return of loyalty and performance was quite significant. So you just have to remind yourself of that. I'll go back to my point that, you know, it's not a fault, but the Australian Defence Force, we actually are a high performer. We most of us join because we want to serve our country. And we want to, you know, be in high performing teams. And then when we perceive that somebody isn't quite like us, we have this unconscious bias. You've got to try and get over that because there's a lot of other really good people trying to do really good work and you need to respect that.
Definitely. And it is, I think what you said about role clarity earlier speaks to that. We want to know what, we all have skills and strengths. We've had certain, you know, expertise is a word that's often that I hear a lot at the training centre. You know, what's your SME? And I wonder if you can speak to that in terms of the work you've done in government and with Border Force, because...
Well, firstly, and going back to my military experience, you know, as a commander, as a leader, to have five really meaningful conversations, say in a warship with, say, 200 people, with five people every day and find out what's important to them, whether it be their family, their work, you should do it because it's a right, because you should know your people. But the disproportional return in terms of performance, I guess loyalty, commitment to the common purpose, it's remarkable. And also you will pick up when people are not either performing to their potential or they're having a bad day. As I said, most people do not start the day saying, I'm going to make it bad for you as a leader.
Right.
It's because there's something generally happening in their life. But if you actually understand them, again, my transitions in leadership have been from a very military environment, you know, at sea, joint task force, to then coming to the government, you know, doing three back-to-back holder government roles from Prime Minister and Cabinet, you know, leading the APEC task force.
Yep.
Maritime Border Command, Operation Sovereign Borders. And then that was, you know, Act 2 in some ways.
Right.
Act 3 then, of course, was transitioning again from military into, the philanthropy and commercial world when I joined Andrew Forrest's Mindaroo Foundation.
Yep.
And then, you know, went into dual-use technology. So I've actually had to make transitions in terms of my leadership style, and also how I've my journey in actually understanding the people I'm working with as well. Yeah. And the other thing, as a general rule as well, when you in the military, you're usually the leader is the most experienced and generally older. Not always, but that's often been a common trait. Of course, when you move into, say, whole of government or in the commercial world, that doesn't ring true. And you've actually got to adapt. As I've often told people who ask my advice about transitioning, you know, from different phases of your career or life, what got you here didn't get you there.
Right.
You need to rewire. And as much as you need to learn new things, you have to unlearn things. Final observations, if I may, just about transitions.
Yeah.
And having seen my kind of cohort, say, from the military transition into either whole of government or the commercial world or to do something different, I have been surprised, again, by those who I didn't think would do it so well who've done it brilliantly and others who I thought would do it well who did not do it as well. And there's probably three reasons. One is when you transition, especially into, say, a government agency, your stories get you a couple of weeks' worth of credibility and gravitas. And then, but after about 4 weeks, people say, start doing something, start working, pull your sleeves up. Even as a Commodore in Prime Minister and Cabinet, I was still expected to write and get in there, et cetera, as well. And I found that those leaders who actually do very well can start things from scratch. Actually have the ability to do it, not just inherit something and make it a little bit better each time iteratively. So I found that you need to rewire, unlearn, get over yourself, tell your stories, then get them out of the way.
Yep.
And then actually start working hard again and have the ability to start things. And then you actually will become a much better leader and a much better performer in your new environments.
It's a great point, I think, about unlearning. I think it's really useful. I think it might be a nice place to talk about inclusive leadership, actually, and talk about this concept of unlearning or different sorts of, priorities that people have. And I wonder if you could just maybe talk about the inclusive leadership review, if there's anything else you want to add about unlearning or... because I think it's such a useful and interesting concept in terms of not just working across the ADF environment, but in the environments you talked about.
Yeah, look, when I say unlearning, there's so many good qualities and experiences that military people or whole of government people or bring not just to the Canberra environment or to Australian society, but there are things that you do need to let go. From a military perspective, and there's no kind of hard and fast for each person,
right?
But there are, as I said, you're influencing people rather than directing people for a start.
Yeah,
and you said your gravitas will only get you so far. In terms of the inclusive leadership review, I was asked to do that in early 2023 by then Chief of the Defence Force Angus Campbell, who had reflected on a number of surveys, in particular of ADF people leaving the Defence Force, and perhaps saying, look, my experience was okay, but I wasn't included as much as I could have been. If I had a different kind of leader who kind of had led me and perhaps had looked out for me or knew me better, perhaps I would have stayed on. I mean, there were other reasons for doing an inclusive leadership, but I think there was a sense that there were examples perhaps overseas of what militaries had done to adapt in terms of inclusive leadership and also other parts of Australian society. And I'd already looked at leadership in the fly-in, fly-out industry, and I'd also looked at it in the building industry as well, small teams far from the centre and how they behave and how they look after their people and how they maintain the values and the core objectives of the centre. So that really was the catalyst for the review. And to be frank, I think there was an assumption the Australian Defence Force, we must be the exemplar academy for leadership and no one can tell us leadership. I think Angus Campbell is saying, well, no, I think we just need to challenge. Have we got the right settings in place, especially those small teams furthest away from the centre where there had been, to be frank, some disappointing issues, perhaps with bullying, separation rates, and at its worst, people feeling really bad about themselves and therefore leading to other significant issues, which of course have been reviewed. So through that journey, we formed a small team a couple of so-called high-performing Australian Defence Force individuals and a couple of people who are high-performing but had experienced those negative
right
experiences that I just alluded to. So we got them together with a few others, and we actually did some surveys. We went out, spoke to people. We went out and looked at the fly-in, fly-out industry. We looked at our police force. We looked at a couple of other militaries about world's best practice and Australian best practice, etc. And there's probably three major outcomes which concerned me, which I reported on. One was especially our junior leaders in those small teams far from the centre. Some of them weren't being prepared or trained or educated for the role. And to be frank, some of them didn't even want to be the leader. But we just, because of their rank or their experience, they were just told, you will lead that team of 20.
Yep.
And because of that, you actually had in some cases where another person took over that leadership role. It could almost be alpha male or alpha female behaviour. And it really changed the dynamics. Mm. And the core values of the Defence Force or of Australia was being lost. The second phenomenon which concerned me was that leaders these days are very busy with other things outside of leadership. Sure, right. There's the core professional responsibilities. But in terms of administration, et cetera, as well, the time to actually lead and know the people is being lost. And then thirdly, I think the centre of an organisation sometimes isn't fully aware of what the last 20 and last 40 is truly doing. Right. In particular, I would describe it as the more unloved units. Sure, there's the loved units, which everyone's focused on, which probably has high morale, etc. But there could be unloved, maybe not as interesting units to the centre or to society, where some of those attributes we want to see in high-performing teams are kind of lost. So the overarching concern I had was absent leadership.
Yeah.
People actually not being prepared for leading, sometimes not actually wanting to lead, but being told they were the leader, and then leaders being too busy to actually lead. And so we address that through some recommendations about how the Australian Defence Force could perhaps reflect, perhaps could be better. And certainly there's an Army, there's an Air Force and a Navy perspective, which we incorporated as well.
Yeah, I'd love to hear a little bit about that. Particularly, you know, this notion of absent leadership is interesting because, you know, maybe from one perspective, there is the sense that the ADF, you know, at the higher ranks that you go, you become more time poor. And so there is a lot more emphasis to say, you know, you need to be on top of all these, whether it's administrative tasks, knowing your team, the actual, you know, meetings and other things you need to go to. And yeah. And what time does one have to really put into any reflective thinking or problem solving? You know, something that's often said about leadership in a business sense is, you know, they're not just problem solvers, but they're problem finders. And I mean, that's great to say, but in what context does the ADF leadership have time to do that sort of stuff? What did the review kind of say about absent leadership in that regard?
Well, first of all, if I just turn it around, I found the number of, especially junior ranked people in the Defence Force said they just simply wanted a leader. They wanted to see leadership. They wanted to see, I don't want to use the word strong, but, you know, they wanted to be led.
Yep.
You know, and when they weren't being led, they were disappointed. That's when, you know. So I think we have to remind ourselves. And again, I go back to early in my career, things that really stuck with me. And I think it was on HMAS Perth. And essentially, it was the night before I was being promoted to midshipman to sub-lieutenant. It might have actually been HMAS Tobruk. And a leading seaman, and we'd been living with the sailors. And the next day, I was about to become a sub-lieutenant rather than a midshipman, which is. But rather than living with the sailors, I was about to live with the officers in the officers' mess or the wardroom. And I remember a leading seaman, a corporal, who'd kind of I got quite close to as, you know, someone who kind of looked out for me, et cetera, said, Lee, because I was just merely a midshipman, then tomorrow I'm going to call you sir. And because you're an officer tomorrow, this Australian way, I'll probably have a go at you because you're an officer. But I tell you what, the moment you stop behaving like an officer and the moment you stop leading, that's when I really have a go at you. Now you need to leave. You need to leave this environment because we've nurtured, we've worked with you. I need you to lead. I need you to know us as sailors, as men going, and women. It was just men back then going forward. So the common theme is just simply lead.
Mm.
Another example, actually, I'll go back to my Navy time. On any ship, every day we do rounds. And that's, you have a ship, and rounds is actually an inspection of the mess decks, where we do rounds every day. It might be 6 p.m. I think it's for three reasons. One is because you're checking the ship to make sure it's clean, and it's, and people, it's in good order. Sure, that's traditionally why you do rounds, whistles and inspections, and it's one time a day. The second is either the captain or another officer with a petty officer, a chief petty officer, will go through every single mess deck and talk to people. And you'll get a sense of how things are happening. And the third one, and hopefully this comes across the right way, is the sailors stand to attention and you go through as an officer and everyone knows for that one moment who's in charge.
Right.
Who is the leader? Yep. That is my leader. That person's accountable to actually lead me.
They're not just in some office in some
Absolutely. Far away. Absolutely. They are leading me and out there. And I think that's actually when you do it. So when you actually have absent leadership, you first of all, who actually is truly leading?
Mm.
Is that person really well prepared and wants to lead and sees it? And thirdly, are they too busy to actually to have those conversations? Or a ship could say, I'm too busy to do rounds today. And if you don't do it for 3 or 4 days, you can tell morale changes. People kind of, you need to continually be engaging your people. I'll give you one other example, fly in, fly out. And I've been to some of those sites. I've met some of the best leaders. And I've met someone who might seem like they're an alpha female or an alpha male when you first meet them, but my goodness, they know their people, and my goodness, they care. They really do. And you can see that. And they're high morale, high spirited, because that leader really cares about that person. Sure, some tough love sometimes as well, but there has to be, but they actually do really know. There's nothing absent about it.
Yeah. It's wonderful because, a good leader personally, you might think, well, I'm fighting for my team. I'm representing them in all these meetings. But, the team don't maybe see those sorts of fights. But they see who's walking the halls, who's sort of part of their team day to day. And so I think that idea of rounds, not just checking, but just being seen is really important.
And engaging, having a genuine conversation. Can I just say one other thing though about inclusive leadership?
Though? Yes.
Obviously, when we talk about diversity, it's diversity in every respect, including diversity of thought, but it's also inclusivity of actually ideas and thought, etc. Military, of course, is a hierarchical system, even in the public service, and even in business, there can be hierarchical systems. But you're a far better warship, you're a far better army unit, air force, squadron, you're a far better organisation here in Canberra if you're inclusive and you're getting that diversity of thought. And I always talk about leadership four aspects. One is obviously there's leadership. Second part is management, making sure you're a good leader, but you have to be a good manager. You can't, probably the number of secretaries of defense who probably turned to chiefs of defense forces and said, gee, you produce good leaders. Can you start producing some good managers as well?
Yeah.
So I think you've got to have both those traits. You've got to lead and manage. Third, you've got to be able to mentor, bring people, And in particular, when you're a captain of a warship or a leader, you've got to make sure that if you aren't there, will the ship or the unit be as good, or if not better, because you're not there. But the fourth concept, leadership, managing, mentoring, is followership. Followership, I reckon, is in two parts. One is actually showing your team how to follow, how you're loyal, how you're, how to follow and be a follower. The other part of a follower is encouraging people to be active followers. When they have the opportunity, that they get to say things and say it well, because you're creating an environment for active followership, which really is in that inclusivity as well. Mm. Making sure that you're not missing, this rich tapestry that you have in a team. And, again, especially in Australia, because of our makeup, because of who we serve a country, but we also reflect a country.
Mm.
When you're reflecting the nation you serve, that diversity and getting that inclusivity of thought is really a force multiplier.
I just want to ask sort of one final question, and you've answered it in a bunch of ways, but I'd just like to see if it resonates or if there's any other thoughts you have about what advice you'd like to give future leaders in the Australian Defence Force who are striving to make a positive impact.
Well, first of all, leadership is an incredibly positive and rewarding experience. I would not, for example, like someone to say the best day of my 2-year leadership role was the last day because nothing bad happened, versus the best day should be the first day because you've got 2 years of actually, you know, either in a department or in a Navy, Army, Air Force unit to actually lead. It's a really positive experience. You shouldn't be worried or, you know, because the ADF actually does prepare people well for leadership, much better than we actually give ourselves credit. It's just sometimes it seems like our leaders are being, you know, held to account, and it's, you know, and it's almost, my goodness, why would I want to do that? Please don't think like that. It's a wonderful experience. And I look back now about not just that the, you know, not every day was a good day in the, you know, the Navy or with government, et cetera, my career, but my goodness, they were great months, great years. I was led by amazing people. I was mentored by amazing people. And I got the opportunity to lead amazing people as well. So my reflection really is, when you join the Defence Force, essentially at some stage we're all leaders. You know, and you could be a quiet leader, you can be a loud leader, you can be, you know, a leader of the whole Defence Force, you can be a leader of a small troop, whatever it may be. Take those opportunities, and because it's really important that, you know, that we continue as Australians, continue to nurture and produce good leaders.
Lee, wonderfully said. It was lovely speaking with you, and you spoke so eloquently about so many of the topics. So thank you for joining us, and thanks for your time.
Look, and can I just say back to you, Lucas, as well. Just you're a defence public servant. Yeah. You know, deep experience in anthropology, even the way that you've conducted it, it's made it really enjoyable for me. I may not have came across this, but you actually are quite nervous when you're talking about leadership because you're opening yourself up to your own experiences. But I've actually really enjoyed this interview, so thank you.
Oh, thanks, Lee.
This episode of Lives in Leadership is copyright Commonwealth of Australia Department of Defence 2025. It is licensed under a Creative Commons by attribution non-commercial no derivatives 4.0 international license. Additional rights beyond this license can be arranged by contacting the.forge@defence.gov.au. For full license details, visit creativecommons.org.